Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1171. The Missing Chapter, Part 1. This is being recorded on February 4th of the year 2021. There, of course, has been rather a lot going on in the political realm. There is simply no way that I can cover all or even most of it in a one-hour radio program, even if I had greater technical resources at my disposal. In that regard, I emphatically encourage listeners to this program to subscribe to the comments that are put up on the SpitfireList.com website, largely, though by no means exclusively, by our contributing editor, Tara Fractal. Tara Fractal has done a remarkable job of covering the Capitol riots, as they have been termed, and related topics, and I emphatically encourage people to subscribe to those comments, because I will be touching on the Capitol riots, as they have been termed, and related topics, but there is no way that I can do justice to all of the things that have been taking place. Also, the flash drive with all of my life's work on it, up through and including, for the record, 1156, done late last fall, is now available. There is a link at the top of each post on the SpitfireList.com website that will enable you to order that flash drive for a tax-deductible contribution of $65 or more. And I do not get any money whatsoever from that flash drive. Now, or from that project. Now, the topic, the title, I should say, of this program, The Missing Chapter, Part 1, refers to, quite literally, a missing chapter from a very important book about Unit 731. That was the very advanced Japanese biological warfare program that was maintained by the Kwantung Army in World War II in Manchuria. After the war, its files and many of its personnel were incorporated into and or liaised with the U.S. Biological Warfare Program. Beyond that, as we have seen in our many treatments of the book Gold Warriors by the late heroic Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, the MacArthur forces in Japan and the Pacific essentially merged with the considerable remnants of the Japanese National Security Establishment, and significant elements of the latter were used clandestinely in the Korean War. Now, the book Unit 731 was co-authored by Peter Williams and David Wallace. They had done a program about that for a British television network, TVS, and that book was, that program rather, was turned into a book. Again, Unit 731, published in hardcover in the UK by Haber, capital H-O-D-B-E-R, and Stoughton, S-T-O-U-G-H-P-O-N. I may be mispronouncing that. And again, this book was published in hardcover in 1989 in the UK. Again, the Haber and Stoughton hardcover edition. There was also a hardcover edition published in the US as well by the Free Press, which is a division of Macmillan Publishers. However, the American hardcover edition omitted an entire chapter from the British edition dealing with allegations of U.S. biological warfare use in China and North Korea during the Korean War. There were some captured American pilots who gave testimony to that effect, to the effect that they had been involved with air dispersal of biological weapons over China and North Korea during the Korean War. These charges created a sensation and outrage in the U.S., and it was those charges that, to a large extent, were the foundation, the genesis for the U.S. mind control programs that became not only standard operating procedure, but a major feature of U.S. intelligence operations and military operations in the post-World War II period. We dealt with the mind control programs in, among other broadcasts, at the AFA programs 5 through 7, a For the Record series excerpting those, and most recently in For the Record program number 1163, we dealt with Louis Jolyon West, who worked both for the military and for the CIA in the MKUltra program, and we dealt with his apparent hypno-programming of a hapless airman, Jimmy Shaver, at Lackland Air Force Base in the early 1950s. It appears that Shaver was placed under mind control and either committed an atrocious killing of a young woman, a young girl, I should say, about 3 years old, 5 years old, something like that, or was hypno-programmed to be convinced that he actually did commit the killings, whereas another individual, and Shaver described a blonde man with tattoos in testimony, committed the killings. Again, it was the testimony, eventually retracted by captured American flyers during the Korean War, that led to not only charges of, quote, brainwashing, unquote, of those POWs, but in reaction to that, or justified by those charges, the MKUltra and other U.S. intelligence and military mind control programs were placed into effect. It is, I think, not only important, but very revealing that a chapter from the British edition of Unit 731, the Haber and Stoughton edition, dealing not only with the very real possibility, I think it is the apparent use of biological warfare in China and North Korea during the Korean War, but the apparent use of Unit 731 personnel and biological warfare tactics that is important here. Because again, this entire chapter was left out of the American edition of the book. Also copyrighted, published in 1989. I'm going to read in this and our next program some key passages from the British edition, and it is worth noting that the author's treatment of the subject is not only very scholarly, but it is very balanced. They do not weight their presentation either in a dogmatic anti-communist point of view, nor do they take the point of view expressed by the North Korean and Chinese communists at face value either. In fact, in treating the testimony of the captured flyers, they note, and I will, when I get to that, will read some of what they say, they view the testimony of the flyers as very possibly having been influenced slash coerced by the Chinese and or North Koreans. By the same token, the authors also view the retraction and all of those flyers retracted their testimony as possibly having been coerced as well. The treatment in this chapter is very objective and very free of ideologized methodology. For that reason, I think the omission of this chapter from the American edition is very telling. The brilliant Berkeley researcher Peter Bale Scott has pointed out that in investigating and researching clandestine operations, quote, the cover-up obviates the conspiracy. But I think the omission of this chapter from the American edition, the American hardcore edition, despite the fact that it is very measured, very objective, and by no means takes what the communist forces said at face value, nor do they take what the Americans necessarily said at face value. I think the omission is very significant and Orwellian in its manifestation. I would point out that in the decades since the Korean War, it has become a matter of public record for those who wish to examine it, that in fact the U.S. National Security Establishment, which incorporated not only Unit 731, but the Project Paperclip people, many of whom were war criminals of the First Order, they have practiced biological warfare on the American people themselves, most recently in addition to our discussion ongoing of the COVID-19 op. In For the Record programs 11, 35, 36, and 37, we took a look at the very compelling and disturbing evidence that Lyme disease was deliberately developed by the U.S. National Security Establishment and also utilized in this country. So, what I'm going to do in this and our next program, it might take three programs. I will wait and see how quickly the reading of the text goes. I'm going to repeat key elements of the text for purposes of emphasis. But again, I'm going to read from the British hardcore edition of Unit 731, all co-authored by Peter Williams and David Wallace, and this chapter was omitted from the American hardcore edition. We're going to begin by taking a look at the profound interest of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the U.S. military in biological warfare as the course of the Korean War progressed, and in particular in late 1951 with the introduction of Soviet-built MiG jet aircraft forcing serious modification of the American air raids involving relatively slow B-29 aircraft to operate during the evening, and a partial, at any rate, attenuation of the interdiction of North Korean and Chinese supply lines, there was an emphatic urgency on the part of the American military command for the vetting of biological warfare. So let us begin by reading some sections of the omitted chapter of Unit 731 by Peter Williams and David Wallace, this from the Haber and Stoughton hardcover edition. It was published in 1989. Records recently released of the American Joint Chiefs of Staff meetings reveal a chronology of rapidly increasing interest in biological warfare during the Korean War. On June 30th, 1950, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or JCS, ordered biological agents to be produced and field tested to determine their military worth for offensive use and tested defenses against those weapons. On February 16th, 1951, military planners requested the Joint Chiefs of Staff for a priority rating for biological warfare agents, as several had reached, quote, pilot plant or production stage of development, unquote. 5 days later, on February 21st, it was agreed to incorporate biological warfare and chemical warfare into strategic planning and into operational and emergency plans, as well as to step up training into and the development of psychological aspects, such as stressing the legitimacy of biological warfare. One more time, this is on February 21st. 5 days later, it was agreed to incorporate biological warfare and chemical warfare into strategic planning and into operational and emergency plans, as well as to step up training and the development of psychological aspects, such as stressing the legitimacy of biological warfare. The Army, which earlier had not wished to use biological warfare, unlike the Navy and the Air Force, was given responsibility for coordination. On December 21st, 1951, nope, almost at the end of 1951, we'll come back to that later. Once again, on December 21st, 1951, Joint Chiefs of Staff files reveal that Defense Secretary Robert Levette have ordered that, quote, actual readiness be achieved in the earliest practicable time, unquote, including agents, munitions, and logistical support for the employment of biological warfare and chemical warfare weapons. One more time. On December 21st, 1951, Joint Chiefs of Staff files reveal that Defense Secretary Robert Levette had ordered that, quote, actual readiness be achieved in the earliest practicable time, unquote, including agents, munitions, and logistical support for the employment of biological warfare and chemical warfare weapons. A week later, on December 28, 1951, the Joint Chiefs of Staff discussed the public relations impact of chemical, biological, or radiological warfare. The aim was to have the public accept and be aware, quote, so far as possible, unquote, of the department's program in chemical warfare, biological warfare, and radiological warfare within 2 years, although no authorized statements were to be made, quote, on possible offensive use, unquote. No moral implications were to be expressed on these categories of weapon and the terms weapon of mass destruction, unquote, and unconventional weapon, unquote, were to be avoided. On February 26, 1952, Air Force Chief of Staff Vandenberg stated, quote, a great deal of progress in the biological warfare, one more time. On February 26, 1952, Air Force Chief of Staff Vandenberg stated, quote, a great deal of progress in the biological warfare field has occurred. Certain offensive capabilities are rapidly materializing. Unquote. Again, that's the Air Force Chief of Staff. As we will see, it appears that many of the biological warfare attacks were generated by aircraft. Continuing. On June 11th, 1952, the need to bring official military doctrine into line with practice was discussed. Some generals proposed a change from using biological warfare in retaliation only, unquote, to use, quote, whenever militarily advantageous, unquote. One more time, on June 11th, 1952, the need to bring official military doctrine into line with practice was discussed. Some generals proposed a change from using biological warfare in retaliation only, unquote, to use when militarily advantageous, unquote. Three parts of the discussion in the document were still censored when it was released in 1980. Again, three parts of the discussion still censored when the document was released in 1980. But the result of it was that the United States could go ahead with biological warfare weapons without any formal change in doctrine, since any formal change in doctrine would upset America's European allies, who were more vulnerable to retaliatory attack. The same document reveals that U.S. policy regarding biological warfare as having great potential, that American security required a, quote, strong offensive biological warfare capacity without delay, unquote, and, quote, without regard for precedent as for their use, unquote, and vigorous, quote, large-scale field tests under operational conditions, unquote, were needed. One more time. The same document reveals that U.S. policy regarded biological warfare as having great potential, that American security required a, quote, strong offensive biological warfare capacity without delay, unquote, and, quote, without regard for precedent as to their use, unquote, and that vigorous, quote, large-scale field tests under operational conditions, unquote, were needed. On January 24, 1953, the Joint Chiefs of Staff stated that progress in biological warfare was too slow and that, quote, there is not yet available to operational commanders a fully developed, adequately tested, effective anti-personnel biological warfare weapon, unquote. Plague was the disease which had the highest priority based on, quote, potential military effectiveness, unquote. Note this. Again, plague was the disease which had the highest priority based on, quote, potential military effectiveness, unquote. Documents in the file refer to reports in July of 1952 by a weapons systems evaluation group, which unfortunately are not concluded in the document that was released. The group's evaluation refers only to the overt use of biological warfare by manned aircraft weapons systems. Years later, the American government admitted that during the Korean War it did have the means to conduct biological attacks, but claimed that its, quote, bacteriological warfare capability was based upon resources available and retained within the continental United States, unquote. And as we will see, I think there is reason to view that with skepticism. Now, what we're going to look at next is a charge by the Chinese Xinhua news agency that British soldiers fighting under the auspices of the UN in Korea were obliged to take secret inoculations for which there was no apparent justification. Now, eventually, corroborating evidence that did not come from Chinese news sources or propaganda sources was, in fact, produced, and the authors go into this as follows. The fact that such mysterious injections did take place has been confirmed recently by another British soldier. The Korean War veteran, a platoon sergeant with the Middlesex Regiment who wishes to remain anonymous, was given a surprise, quote, booster, unquote, injection one day in December of 1950. Quote, "We were not told what it was for," he recalls. "We thought at the time it was peculiar as we had been given our two TAB and TT injections in July of 1950 before we flew out to Korea. TAB, typhoid and paratyphoid A and B, and TT, tetanus toxoid inoculations were, as now, standard injections. A primary is given followed by a second shot 4 to 6 weeks later. Boosters are only required every 3 years. No extra booster," unquote, would have been needed nearly 6 months later. The mystery is, however, much deeper. Just over a week before injection, this soldier was leading his platoon south during the UN retreat from the Chinese. He recalls the events, parenthetically, in the Korean War, after the Incheon landings by MacArthur and UN forces, and after the forces, by the way, against the counsel of quite a few military intelligence officers in this country, approached the Yalu River in the border with China, the Chinese launched a devastating attack across the border and drove the UN forces very far south. That is what this, that is the military context in which this takes place. Now back to this British platoon sergeant with the Middlesex Regiment. "In November 1950, I was with forces sitting on the Yalu River. We spent 3 to 4 weeks just south of the river near Chosan. The front then collapsed with the Chinese intervention and there was a rapid retreat. It was called the Pusan Derby. During the retreat, we went to Pakchan, then Simanju, then Kunari. After Kunari, K-U-N-A-R-I, there was a massive Chinese ambush. One day's march, that is 20 to 30 miles south from Kunari, which was a small place but an important pass and large railway junction, we came to a small village. My platoon was bringing up the rear of the 27th Brigade. We were, literally, the last troops out. In the village, there were American military police, half a dozen jeeps, and 2 or 3 other odd sort of vehicles. In shape, they could have been ambulances, but they didn't have any Red Cross identifying marks. I'd never seen vehicles like these before. The military police, there were 15 or 16 of them, had their white helmets on. They were nicknamed snow gooses," unquote. And this astonished me as this wasn't the sort of weather for that headgear. Coming off the road, I told the American MPs that we were the last of the UN forces and that behind us there were only Chinese. I was told to clear off in no uncertain terms. They were very peculiar and it was extremely odd to be given this treatment when we were trying to give some advice. As we were walking through the village, I saw other chaps in fatigues who were very busy. It looked as if they had just gotten into the village. First, I saw 3 or 4 of them with handfuls of feathers going into houses. They looked like fowl feathers. Then I saw them picking the feathers out of containers and going into houses. They were running in and out spreading the feathers. They were holding the feathers at a distance from their bodies, not in the normal way. I would not have noticed the feathers otherwise. These other men had parkas on and were wearing gloves, which we all had, but they were also wearing masks over their faces. Other than that, they had no identifying insignia. The containers with the feathers were about 18 in by 18 in by 24, with snap fasteners reminding me of our Dixie containers, which were used to keep food warm for 24 hours. It was about 20 below then. It was all very fishy. They were very surprised and very unhappy to see us. It was obvious that something suspicious was going on, and that it was a clandestine affair. We marched on through the village and south, but 18 hours later, we went back through the village. This was to go back to Kumari to get the Turkish brigade out. The Turks and an American regimental combat team were annihilated, however. We didn't stop in the village this time, or on the way back again 6 to 8 hours later, as we were in motorized transport. The Americans were not in the village, and what was surprising was that we never saw them come past us when there was only one road out. One more time. The Americans were not in the village, and what was surprising was that we never saw them come past us when there was only one road out. The village itself was probably 6 to 8 miles from the sea, so I presume they may have been specially evacuated out that way. But that would have been unusual. It was just over a week later that we were given our injections. And then the authors go on to comment. The use of infected feathers and the use of special tactical biological warfare retreats, as we have seen, were both standard methods employed by Unit 731 during the Second World War. Furthermore, it is known from classified documents that the Biological Department of the U.S. Chemical Corps was, at this time, experimenting with feathers as carriers of biological agents. 3 or 4 months, and then the soldier's account is, the British platoon sergeant's account resumes. 3 or 4 months later, near Haeju and south of Sariwon, S-A-R-I-W-O-N, the same soldier saw hundreds of dead bodies of Chinese soldiers in military uniform lying in open fields. Quote, "They did not look as if they had been wounded or shot," he recalls. "The bodies were a month or so old, and they were just lying there. We were told that the Chinese army had gotten cholera. This was in about April, when we advanced and the snows were beginning to melt." Now, note in the section about American biological warfare policy that we read, the incorporation of army forces into biological warfare readiness programs was introduced, whereas previously that had just been the Navy and the Air Force. The authors then go on to comment, "It is possible that the Americans felt pressed into using biological warfare when, later in 1951, and again, notice in our reading of the American biological warfare doctrine as it increased in importance and urgency during the progress of the Korean War. In late 1951, there was a significant uptick in the emphasis on biological warfare. Now, resuming with this passage, "It is possible that the Americans felt pressed into using biological warfare when later in 1951, the introduction of Russian-built MiG fighters wrested much of the U.S. Air Force's supremacy in the air. The MiGs forced the big, slow, relatively unwieldy American B-29 bomber to shift over to night bombing. Air Chief of Staff General Hoyt S. Vandenberg's glamorously organized Operation Strangle, unquote, a night and day interdiction program aimed at destroying all the enemy's vital supply routes, failed in its purpose. Unit 731, as we have seen, placed great emphasis on using biological warfare to disrupt supply routes. One more time. Unit 731, as we have seen, placed great emphasis on using biological warfare to disrupt supply routes. And about the possibility, I believe that is, for all intents and purposes, a certainty of not only methodology developed by Unit 731, but some of the personnel as well, having been involved in the apparent biological warfare campaign in Korea. The authors write as follows. Were the Japanese involved? Did ex-members of Unit 731 participate in the American Biological Warfare Program? It is one of the most intriguing questions of Unit 731's secret story. On December 5th, 1951, a month or so before the outbreak of the alleged American Biological Warfare Campaign in Korea, a telepress dispatch from Rangoon, Burma, reported that two U.S. officials who were unwilling to disclose their names had revealed that General Matthew Ridgway had sent former Japanese generals Ishii, parenthetically the commander of Unit 731, Kitano, K-I-T-A-N-O, and Wakamatsu, W-K-A-M-A-T-S-U, to Korea with a freighter carrying, quote, all the necessary equipment, unquote, which included cholera germs, a gas which induced blood poisoning, and plague germs. The ISC's final report had referred to this and other dispatches when it stated that, quote, in the early months of 1952, newspaper items had reported two successive visits of Shiro Ishii to South Korea, and he was there again in March of 1952. This last couple of sentences again. I'm sure you got this long sentence. I'll read that whole passage. On December 5th, 1951, a month or so before the outbreak of the alleged American biological warfare campaign in Korea, a telepress dispatch from Rangoon, Burma, reported that two U.S. officials who were unwilling to disclose their names had revealed that General Ridgway had sent former Japanese generals Ishii, Kitano, and Wakamatsu to Korea with a freighter carrying, quote, all the necessary equipment, unquote, which included cholera germs, a gas which induced blood poisoning, and plague germs. The ISC's final report had referred to this and other dispatches when it stated that, quote, in the early months of 1952, newspaper items had reported two successive visits of Shiro Ishii to South Korea, and he was there again in March of 1952. Note that in the passage we read about American biological warfare planning and the acceleration in not only operational planning but the apparent urgency, talked about plague as an optimum weapon. And the authors go on to comment, some of the stories can be corroborated. Local residents in the Wakamatsu Cho district where General Ishii lived had confirmed that the former general did, quote, disappear, unquote, some years after the end of the Pacific War. Now we're going to begin reading next the story of the ISC. That is the International Scientific Commission for the Facts Concerning Bacterial Warfare in Korea and China, and it was prepared with Chinese and North Korean assistance. And this document, again, was very rigorous methodologically, and the vast majority of the personnel involved were not Chinese or North Korean military or medical personnel. The authors, and probably in our next program, I will read some of the editorial framing of the presentation that the authors present. The authors are very objective ideologically. They neither take the testimony of the captured airmen at face value, necessarily pointing out that it may have been funky, so to speak, it may have been coerced, nor do they take the retractions of those same airmen at face value either, pointing out that there's evidence that that may have been coerced as well. The thing that I think is so significant here is the fact that it was the testimony of those airmen, whether it was coerced or whether their retractions were coerced and the confessions were substantively accurate, that led to the U.S. development of the mind control programs, whose scale and development could not be exaggerated in importance. Essentially, satanic in its manifestation. And again, the fact that this chapter, very balanced, very objective in terms of its presentation, was omitted completely from the American edition of the book. Now, the authors go on to point out, or they point out that the ISC was very scientific in its methodology, and the document itself is very credible. They also point out that their eventual inclusion of the testimony of the captured airmen weakened the credibility of the presentation itself. And in our next program, I will make a point of repeating or emphasizing the non-ideologized and objective treatment of this investigation. Again, it's called the ISC, that is the International Scientific Commission for the Facts Concerning Bacterial Warfare in Korea and China. And we will talk about the personnel in this in just a second. The authors write, and again, we will continue with this in our next program. We won't have time to talk about it here. One source of information, the report of the international, you know what, though, I think, let me point out, I think, the objective, non-ideologized weighting by the authors. The analysis of charges, denials, and counter-accusations remains a treacherous minefield. As the Chinese and North Koreans have made the charges, the burden of proof fell upon them to substantiate their accusations. Most evidence that can be inspected today thus comes predominantly from communist sources. The allegations may be true, but it must be remembered that at the time, with the notable exception of the Khabarovsk trial record, that was a Russian war crimes trial of the Unit 731 personnel, the customary verbiage which enveloped communist propaganda often had a poor record on truth. Again, the authors are very meticulous about avoiding an ideologized presentation here, and they view the communist propaganda or presentation with, I think, the proper degree of distance and objectivity. That having been said, the authors then go on to discuss the ISC. One source of information, the report of the International Scientific Commission of the Facts Concerning Bacterial Warfare in Korea and China, which was prepared with Chinese and North Korean assistance, is generally accepted today as being of very high quality. The ISC was formed on March 29. Let me read that one more time. One source of information, the report of the International Scientific Commission for the Facts Concerning Bacterial Warfare in Korea and China, which was prepared with Chinese and North Korean assistance, is generally accepted today as being of high quality. The ISC was formed on March 29, 1952, by a meeting in Oslo of the Executive Committee of the World Peace Council, an organization which reportedly received some backing from Moscow. Addressing the committee, Dr. Kuo Mojo, president of the Chinese People's Committee for World Peace, called for the formation of an international group of impartial and independent scientists to investigate the biological warfare allegations. One more time. Addressing the committee, Dr. Kuo Mojo, president of the Chinese People's Committee for World Peace, called for the formation of an international group of impartial and independent scientists to investigate the biological warfare allegations. And next, the authors present those scientists, and they are indeed independent and estimable. One of them eventually rose to a very prestigious position at Cambridge University in the UK. Continuing with the author's discussion of the formation of the ISC. Later in June of that year, that would be 1952, the six principal members of the ISC arrived in Peking to commence their investigation. They were Dr. Andrea Andreen, A-D-N-D-R-E-E-N, Director of the Central Laboratory of the Hospitals Board of the City of Stockholm, Sweden. Jean Malpere, M-A-L-P-E-R-R-E. Ingenier Agricole, Director of the Laboratory of Animal Physiology, National College of Agriculture, Grignon, France. Dr. Oliviero Olivo, O-L-I-V-O, Professor of Human Anatomy in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Bologna, Italy. Dr. Samuel Pessoa, P-E-S-S-O-A, Professor of Parasitology at the University of São Paulo and formerly Director of Public Health for the State of São Paulo in Brazil. Dr. Nikolai Zhukov-Verezhnikov, Professor of Bacteriology at and Vice President of the Soviet Academy of Medicine and formerly Chief Medical Expert at the Kavarovsk Trial of Unit 731. And finally, Dr. Joseph Needham, N-E-E-D-H-A-N, F-R-S, Sir William Dunn Reader in Biochemistry, Cambridge University, formerly Scientific Counselor for Her Britannic Majesty's Embassy, Chongqing, and later Director of the Department of Natural Sciences for UNESCO. He became, in 1966, the Master of Gonville and Caius College, Cambridge, and is currently writing a history of science and civilization in China. I'm going to read this one more time because, again, I think the contemporary American or perhaps even Western political slash intellectual palette is likely to be slanted against anything that was tainted in any way by Chinese or North Korean investigation. Note that the committee with the Executive Committee of the World Peace Council was encouraged to form an international group of impartial and independent scientists to investigate the biological warfare allegations. One more time. They were Dr. Andrea, A-N-D-R-E-A, Andreen, A-N-D-R-E-E-N, Director of the Central Laboratory of the Hospitals Board of the City of Stockholm, Jean Malpere, Ingenieur Agricole, Director of the Laboratory of Animal Physiology, National College of Agriculture, Grignon, France, Dr. Oliviero Olivo, Professor of Human Anatomy in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Bologna, Italy, Dr. Samuel Pessoa, P-E-S-S-O-A, Professor of Parasitology at the University of San Paolo, and formerly Director of Public Health for the state of San Paolo, Brazil. Dr. Nikolai Zhukov-Verezhnikov, Professor of Bacteriology at and Vice President of the Soviet Academy of Medicine and formerly Chief Medical Expert at the Khabarovsk Trial. And finally, Dr. Joseph Needham, FRS, Sir William Dunn Reber in Biochemistry, Cambridge University, formerly Scientific Counselor for Her Britannic Majesty's Embassy in Chongqing, and later, Director of the Department of Natural Sciences at UNESCO. He later became, in 1966, the Master of Gonville, G-O-N-V-I-L-L-E, and Caius, C-A-I-U-S, College, Cambridge, and is currently, that would be in 1989, writing History of Science and Civilization in China. On the Chinese side, an illustrious array of scientists and medical men, many trained in the West, was arranged to assist the commission. In Peking between June 23rd and July 9th, the ISC began to try to unravel the threads of the situation. As historical background for the ISC's first meeting, Zhukov-Verezhnikov presented Russian evidence about Unit 731 gained at Khabarovsk. Needham's notebook, Joseph, Dr. Joseph Needham. By the way, he notes in a passage which we'll probably get to in our next program. He notes that the people he worked with from China were people he had known well and had worked with during the Second World War. Bear in mind, this was only a few years after World War II. Beginning again. As historical background for the ISC's first meeting, Zhukov-Verezhnikov presented Russian evidence about Unit 731 gained at Khabarovsk. Needham's notebook records records that Zhukov-Verezhnikov was asked whether it would be reasonable to infect any insects by bringing them into contact with germs of infectious diseases. Zhukov-Verezhnikov answered that it was theoretically possible, even with arachnids, the genus including spiders, scorpions, and mites, and that the numbers of types of potential insect vectors had constantly been increasing, especially for plant diseases. At the ISC's second meeting on June 27th, the Chinese produced surviving materials relating to Japanese bacterial warfare waged against them during the Second World War. Original reports from the archives of the Chinese Ministry of Health dealing with the Xiangpei plague incident were produced. Other official Chinese records showed that 11 cities had been attacked in this way, 4 in Zhejiang province, 2 each in Hopi, Ethiopia and Hunan, and 1 each in Shaanxi, Hunan, and Shantung. By the way, I'm probably butchering many of these Chinese pronunciations and very possibly doing the same thing with many of the Japanese pronunciations as well. I don't speak either language. Continuing. The meeting also received a communication which had arrived the night before from newspaper man Wilfred Burchett, or Burchett, B-U-R-C-H-E-P-P, erstwhile Daily Mail correspondent in Berlin, but then covering the Korean War from the communist side for French left-wing Daily Ce Soir. In his letter, Burchett claimed that at about 2 p.m. on June 6th, he had been sitting in a jeep on a ferry on the, crossing an arm of the upper reaches of the Yalu River when he noticed that the water was very thickly covered with insects of two varieties. Obviously not aquatic creatures, they were trying to struggle aboard the ferry. The next day, it transpired that the phenomenon had coincided with several similar ones in the region, and that all had accompanied the passage of American aircraft. Non-exploding bombs had been seen to fall. Bruchette stated that he had talked to the principal of a nearby school where boys playing in the playground on hearing planes and while rushing for cover had seen, quote, silvery globes, unquote, coming down, apparently rather slowly in a diagonal direction. Later, they went to the point of landing and found masses of insects. Three boys Bruchette talked to have said that the globes were about twice as large as footballs and that the insects found were about 1 inch long with a large and prominent abdomen and with constantly moving mouth parts. The principal problem facing the ISC was to establish a rigorous methodology through which it would be possible to provide internationally acceptable scientific proof about whether or not biological warfare was being waged. The commission had already observed that biological warfare, on account of its very nature, was exceptionally difficult to prove. The specific methodology of the commission evolved with which to analyze biological warfare incidents was charted out in an explanatory diagram. It is necessary to envisage a manner of grouping events into a coherent pattern so that they can throw light upon each other and perhaps build up a circumstantial case. The simplest scheme in which, under ideal conditions, every component would be present was the following. And then there is a diagram, which obviously I can't do justice to on the air. Continuing. Naturally, this pattern will rarely or never be encountered in the beginning again. Naturally, this complete pattern will rarely or never be encountered. There are nevertheless cases which come near enough to it to be decisive. In this way, it is possible to reconstruct the activities of those who have utilized such methods and to elucidate the effects which have been produced by them. The Commission paid particular attention to those assemblies of facts which attained most nearly the demonstrative character to the ideal pattern. When the general complex of facts resulting from the confrontation of numerous patterns is examined, the whole situation becomes clear. In attempting to verify each biological warfare incident, the ISC had to consider complicated arguments about medical and entomological evidence discovered after the alleged raids. And we will continue with this in our next program. Again, note that the authors here are very objective, and they do a very good job, I think, of ideologically de-waving or de-ideologizing the information presented here. And again, the ISC, that report is viewed of being, as being of very high quality. We will continue with this in our next program. This concludes For the Record, program number 1171, The Missing Chapter, Part 1. This is being recorded on February 4th of the year 2021. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.